panel this morning. We'll hear three cases. Three of them have gone off on briefs. Two have gone off on the briefs. One has been continued. So we'll start this morning with the first case, United States versus Ily. You'll straighten this out, I'm sure. 17-12-69. We're ready to hear you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Josh Lee, and my client's name is Don Ily. The question presented in this case is whether the district court erred in applying the fraud guidelines contempt enhancement. That enhancement applies where the defendant's fraud violated any prior specific judicial or administrative order. In this case, the Colorado Board of Accountancy had previously found that Mr. Ily committed negligence in the practice of accounting. And as a result, it ordered four things: that Mr. Ily pay a fine, that he submit his practice to independent monitoring, that he file quarterly reports.
I'll tell you what troubled me about your argument, and so I want you to help me through this. The order, I think paragraph 45, 46, 47, seem to be the operative paragraphs in a way, but they're not to be read independently. They're to be read in the context of the entire document, the entire administrative order. And the order says, based upon the foregoing facts, and the foregoing facts would seem to me to include the recitation of those paragraphs, I think 13 through 26, which were the paragraphs that relate to the conduct that was being charged in those administrative proceedings, which are three cases, right?
Three cases?
Weren't there three cases, three individual clients?
I think that there were maybe four.
Oh, right. Well, five. I'm referring to three that I read specifically about. Many of it, each of those included not filing returns in a timely manner, correct?
No, only one of them did.
All right. Well, one of them did. What did the other two involve?
So the others were about giving clients deductions that they weren't entitled to, failing to give clients deductions that they were entitled to, failing to find all of the client's reportable income, things like that.
All right. So one for not filing and two for being pretty sloppy in their work.
There were just various and sundry right. instances of him being negligent.
Were now, there any that involved not forwarding the money to the IRS?
One.
Yeah,
that's
just the one.
Right.
Now, and so we now have before us in this case a situation of fraud. And the fraud allegedly is he would not file, he would tell the client we owe X, and then the clients would either prepay or they would withhold, whatever method or manner. And then he'd file a false return. And the return said something else. So basically it involved filing of a different sort. So the only question is this type of fraud the type of fraud that subsumes or integrates an element of non-filing, the negligence based on non-filing. And if that's true and those are the facts, aren't we dealing with the same animal?
So those aren't the facts.
Set me free.
There's two distinct parts of the order.
Right.
And the first part of the order is about the violations that Mr. Ily committed, which is what we've been talking about. The second part of the order is addressed to the LLC, and that's the paragraphs 45 through 47, and that's where the warning comes in.
Which speaks to registration and that kind
exactly.
of thing.
Exactly. So the order specifically says that the warning is imposed for the violations that the LLC committed. And those are limited to failing to register as a group of accountants, holding yourself out as a group of accountants without registration and performing accounting without registration.
Well, I thought this that the order related to both Don Illy personally and conjunctively the firm.
The order as a whole does. Paragraphs 45 through 47 do not, because that part of the order specifically says that it only applies to his firm and only applies to the registration violations that I discussed.
So you're saying that Illy wasn't sanctioned at all?
No.
Only Illy, the LLC was.
No, Illy was sanctioned with the four sanctions that I mentioned, that he was fined, independent monitoring, continuing education, and quarterly reports.
Well, with respect to the sanctions against him, the monitor was supposed to do, I guess, call it surprise audits. So Mr. Illy wouldn't know which clients were being audited or the returns for which clients. Every 6 months, was it?
Yes.
And if he found anything, he was supposed to report to the board. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And he'd already been fined $10,000.
Yes.
Would anyone have any doubt that if he repeated the same sorts of violations, any of those four, and that was found in an audit, that there would be additional sanctions?
So he would be, I'm certain that if this was uncovered, that he would have had his license revoked, but not for violating the order. He would have had his license revoked because he's a repeat offender, because he committed fraud. But that's not what this enhancement is about.
Why not for violating the order? It, as it relates to his conduct, as it relates to client C, he did exactly the same thing. The only difference being that they, in the order, they called it negligence. In this situation, it's called he had a higher level of intent. So why not? I mean, if the auditor had come and found him doing exactly the same thing and said, oh, wow, well, in this instance, you had a higher level of intent, I'm going to walk away? I don't think so.
Right. But the order didn't have an explicit directive not to commit the same conduct again.
It related to the same conduct.
It did, and that's not enough.
Well, that's what you say. That's what we're here to determine. And so that, and to your point about this, and I hope you have the guideline book in front of you or the commentary, because one thing that struck me when I was reading through the commentary is when you look at the hypothetical that they gave you, in that hypothetical, there was no symmetry in the level of intent. That's the argument. One of the arguments you're making here relates to, oh, well, you know, in the order it was negligence, now this is something else. In the exact commentary of the guidelines, there's no symmetry as it relates to intent. The guideline speaks of selling a dangerous product, the commentary, and then it goes on to say then doing it fraudulently. Well, there's no necessary relationship between the first violation and the second. So why doesn't that undercut your position that the guidelines require this symmetry of intent?
It may be against the second position that I've advanced, but it supports the first position, because in the example, there's an explicit injunction, do not sell this product. And that's what we don't have here, and that matters, because contempt is an independent wrong, a distinctive form of lawlessness that warrants its own punishment.
Well, I saw this is not a contempt case. I saw your supplemental authority about that. What authority do you have that suggests that that is even opposite
it
to this
is,
situation?
It is a contempt case based on the language of the guideline and the commentary. What the guideline is driving at is someone who commits contempt. So if you look at the commentary, what they say is that the defendant violates something that, quote, takes the form of an order to take or not to take a specified action. That is exactly the language of contempt.
It speaks of warning, too. It uses the word in contravention of an official judicial or administrative warning. Well, why isn't warning exactly what he got? And let me make this point. Nash, you know, even if you quibble with whether Nash is relevant here, whether Nash should be applied here full force, the fact of the matter is this case was arguably stronger than Nash, because in Nash, the court relied upon the penalty itself. Here, you had a clear prospective orientation. He was under probation. He was under a warning not to do this stuff. I mean, how could one not understand you couldn't do that?
Well, the test isn't notice, and for respectfully,
it says warning in the, in the commentary.
I just think Nash got it wrong.
It says warning in the commentary.
Let me put it this way.
That's all right. Go ahead. I have a question, but go ahead. I'll follow your
question. Why isn't this order the equivalent of a warning? Couldn't it be clear that if you do this again, there's going to be a monitor looking at it who has to report to us, and we've already imposed a $10,000 fine? It could be much worse. Isn't that a warning?
So the guidelines say a warning in the form of an order to take or not to take a specified action. And that's what we don't have. We don't have an order to take or not to take the action.
Well, not so quick. What about paragraph 32? What about paragraph 32? Does it apply to Illy?
Which is paragraph 32?
Upon approval by the board of the practice monitor, respondent Illy agrees, : That one. That applies to Illy, right?
Yes, that does apply to Illy.
All right. Now, under the terms of the practice monitor, Illy agreed under paragraph C that he would meet the generally accepted professional standards for tax services, that he would evaluate, monitor, improve the quality of the practice, that he would authorize the practice monitor to visit and review the practice to determine that these things were being done. Now, do you think that includes a little fraud?
I'd have to take a look at that. I don't remember that language. Uh-huh. But, again,
well, please do at some point.
The guideline says that it has to be a specific order. Any sort of general order, don't violate the law, would not be a specific order. I think it's useful to compare the language of this guideline that talks about violating a specific order and an order not to take a specified action. If you look at guideline 4A1.3A2C, which I discussed in my briefs, that one says that you get an upward departure if you have prior misconduct established by a civil adjudication. So that is the language that the commission would have used if it wanted this guideline to cover conduct like that.
Did the practice monitor report anything in this case?
That's not in the record. There's no evidence that the practice monitor reported anything in this case.
And you use the word specific. Well, we specifically talked. We detailed what specific means in Pintrick. And in Pintrick, we said it means adequate warning. And so that's what you got here. You know, you use that word. Well, that word has been given context by our court. And that word means adequate warning. How could he not have adequate warning?
Well, in Pintrack, you had a specific order not to commit fraud. And we don't have that here.
The court interpreted what specific means
in
the context.
Well, it was explicit in Pintrack, is what I'm saying. There's two separate points, whether the order is narrow enough and whether it's explicit. And in Pintrack, it was explicit. Don't commit fraud. And we don't have that here. It's also, if you compare the commentary of the guideline we're talking about here, where there's an explicit injunction not to sell this product again, if you look at the commentary to the other guideline that I'm talking about, the Chapter 4 guideline, it gives us an example, a similar large-scale fraudulent misconduct established by an adjudication of the Securities and Exchange Commission. So that's a separate guideline that talks about a departure. And that's the sort of guideline that would apply based solely on a prior adjudication for similar misconduct. This one about violating a specific order is just apples and oranges where there was not an explicit injunction not to do it.
Did you want to reserve time?
Yes, please. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Carl Schock representing the United States. The order here placed the defendant on probation for, among other things, taking money from a client for the purpose of paying payroll taxes and then failing to properly remit those taxes to the IRS. For the entire period that the defendant was on probation, he did the same thing over and over again, this time fraudulently and this time for more than 140 clients, and that's what led to his conviction here. So the conduct was the same.
The argument would be that that conduct, even though it's of the same ilk, was not either characterized or determined to be fraud in the administrative proceedings. Is that right?
That's correct. The administrative proceedings characterize it as negligence, but the act is the same. The act is taking money from client and then failing to properly remit it to the IRS. It just simply wouldn't make sense if it was a violation of the order to do that negligently, but if you do it on purpose, you get around the order. And in fact, what the order or what the guidelines commentary is clear about is that this guideline is focused on an aggravated criminal intent. And so if you take something you did negligently before and then do it fraudulently, that actually shows a greater aggravated criminal intent.
Well, it's supposed to also give you warning. And so why necessarily, if there is a disconnection between the level of intent, why would that necessarily have given you warning that you are violating the order? Not that you're not committing a crime, but that you are violating that order. Why does that necessarily follow?
Because it gives you warning that the act of taking this money and failing to properly remit it to the IRS is a violation regardless of the mind state. I mean, it wouldn't be a rational interpretation of the order to say, well, that gives me notice that if I do it negligently, well, then I'm doing something wrong. But if I do it fraudulently, then I'm doing something okay.
It's not that it's okay. It's the question of whether it violates the order. Those are two
right.
different things. I mean, you could have been on notice that you were doing something wrong, but not necessarily violating the order. And just so that I can be clear, I'm not saying I don't, you know, there isn't some plausibility in your argument. I'm just trying to understand, do you have a case that stands for that proposition that would suggest that this higher level of scienter associated essentially necessarily means that there is notice of violation of the order?
I don't have a case on that point, but I think you brought up the commentary example, which does not have that symmetry between the prior order, which was simply an order not to do the act at all, and then the subsequent act, which was fraud. I would liken this to that. The order here, as I would interpret it, and as I think the appropriate interpretation, is the prohibited act is the act itself, and the mind state is irrelevant to that act.
Counsel,
yes.
Your opposing counsel spoke in terms of there not being an explicit order, and I was looking for the language explicit in the rule. Is that in the rule?
Explicit is not in the rule. I would point out, just so the court doesn't get confused by this if it looks at this later, Pentrac does say the injunction must be explicit. However, it's equating explicit with the word specific, and then it goes on to say that specific refers to the nature of the defendant's conduct.
So in other words, notice. Right.
In other words, it must be sufficiently specific as to what conduct is at issue to give the defendant adequate notice of what's at issue. So the only place that I've seen explicit is in Pentrac, but I think that it's different because it's talking about what the nature of the conduct is. And I would say that what may not be explicit in this text is very unambiguous in the context of the order. This order, in addition to the probation, which I think Judge Holmes, you brought up a good point, which is, this is stronger than Nash because he did this while he was under probation. So perhaps it might be a more difficult case if we were in the Nash world where all we had was a fine. Here we actually have an ongoing prospective probation that is in effect and imposes all of these requirements. But in addition to that probation.
Worse than that, you've got a practice monitor under which you assure the commission that you are not going to do certain acts in furtherance of that agreement or promise, you agree to be monitored to make sure you don't do that.
Correct. That and the explicit statement that this exact conduct violates state law and accounting rules. And read in context with all of these requirements, the order isn't simply punishing past behavior. It's clearly designed to prevent this behavior going forward. And what Pentrac says, to the extent it does have any relevance here, is it says that where an order is designed to prohibit conduct and then provides notice of that conduct, that it satisfies the rule. I also want to mention two specific provisions here. Again, I acknowledge the words "you must stop" do not appear in the order, but I want to focus on two provisions here that I think make that message even more clear. The first is one that was already brought up, which is the fact that the practice monitor was required to report to the board on whether the defendant followed relevant laws and to inform the board immediately if the defendant violated state law or accounting rules. I think clear from that provision is first that continued unlawful conduct is prohibited, and then second that the board would take further action if there were further violations. So to the extent that an explicit warning is required, we're getting awfully close there. The second provision is this requirement that the defendant submit quarterly reports as to whether the defendant was in compliance with the order. In context, that compliance couldn't have been limited to these four narrow terms that the defendant cites, because
but
quarterly
aren't you deficient in failing to provide us with any information regarding that aspect of the case? There's no report from the monitor. There's no determination that there has been a failure to comply with generally accepted standards, et cetera, et cetera. None of that's in the record, is it?
As to whether the board determined that there had been a violation?
As to whether anybody even reported that there had been a violation, either self-reporting or monitor reporting.
Correct. There's nothing into the record as that. What I'm focused on here is what the order is intended to convey. And the order itself, not what came later, but the order itself is intended to convey that if you do these things, if you violate the law, the board will continue to be involved.
And he arguably did a good job of concealing his conduct, right? Because he got off. He was released early from his probation.
He was, and clearly through a false statement. And I think that the letter that he wrote actually further supports the interpretation here as to what all parties understood here. Because when the defendant sought that early release from practice monitoring, he didn't simply say, I've paid the fine, I've gone to my continuing education, I've had a practice monitor. Instead, what he focused on was the supposed, and we now know false, change in his behavior. So he said, I want to be released not because I've done those four things, but because of my improvements in accuracy, diligence, and candor. And so it's clear that to the defendant, he understood that he was supposed to stop.
Now, the indictment, and I gather the plea also, covers a period of time where this misconduct occurred that includes time when he was under the order and a time when he was free from the order.
Correct.
Does that make a difference if, for example, all this conduct was after he'd been relieved of probation? Would that end your argument?
I don't think it would end it. It would make my argument more difficult because I think the fact that he was on probation makes us very strong. I don't think it would end it because even if it was after he was off probation, we still have an order that's not simply he did the same thing twice. We have an order that was very, very specific about what the conduct was at issue. So he went before the board.
But he wasn't violating it if he was no longer on probation.
That's true. And in that case, we would be pretty much in the exact world of Nash. And it would be whether the court agrees with Nash that a fine can be treated as an order to stop. The Nash court held that it is. I concede that that would be a more difficult case, and I would make the argument that the court adopted in Nash. I would say here the court doesn't have to go that far because he was under probation for at least part of the conduct. And
that
it doesn't
was a weakness in Nash, you would agree, that it had to rely on that.
I think that Nash was certainly a more difficult case. But I would say the Joku case followed Nash, and I would also want to mention that the Montes case, which wasn't cited in the brief, but it's in the Goldberg case, which was cited in our brief, that case also applied this guideline to an administrative order that did not contain an express order to stop. So
they relied, I think Joku talked about Montes involving a seizure, right? And
right.
So the seizure was the concrete act. As was the penalty in Nash.
Right, right. There was a concrete act, but there was not an explicit word.
Yes.
Okay. And so I would say that all of those cases do support this idea that we're not looking for explicit words, "you must stop." What we're looking for is what the order, how the parties understood the order, and all of that.
Doesn't 2B1 basically require a showing of a violation of a prior specific administrative order?
It does.
So why would it matter in terms of your answers to both of my colleagues about probation, whether the probation had expired or not? That seems to me quite irrelevant. I mean, it didn't require any order that was extant. It says any prior order.
Yeah, because I think I'm addressing two different issues. That I think you're focused on the specificity of the order. I think that the defendant's argument is that this is not an order at all. I mean, essentially that there's no directive in place. And so I think the fact that he's on probation makes very clear that he's in violation of the order.
That it has a prospective orientation.
Correct.
As opposed to an order that by its terms had expired in its purpose.
Correct.
And that would be a different matter.
Yeah. And I don't think there's any question, or there shouldn't be any question here, as to the specificity of the order. So if this order is, as the government argues, an order to stop the behavior, there's no question that it's specific as to what behavior is required to stop. It is the same conduct, and again, we address the mens rea issue. That's the only theoretical way to distinguish them, but the act itself is the exact same act. Just one last point I want to make. I do want to mention the Goldberg case because it is kind of hanging out there. And although the defendant didn't cite it, I just want to make sure I address it. The issue in Goldberg, I just want to make clear, was a different one because the issue there, or the administrative action there, was simply a notice. There was no involvement by the defendant. There was no punishment imposed. And so the question there was whether there was an administrative order at all. Not the interpretation of that order. Here, there's no dispute this was an administrative order. The defendant participated in it. It led to a meaningful action, and for all the reasons I've explained, that meaningful action included the directive not to continue to engage in that behavior. If the court has no further questions, the government would request that the defendant's sentence be affirmed.
May I ask a question to start with? With respect to the term explicit, you're relying, Justin, on our precedent, not on the guideline or the commentary itself for that term. Is that right?
Yeah, and I think that the word specific in the guideline is a synonym of explicit. That's what it means.
Well, when you referred to our precedent for that point, there was no question it was explicit in that case, right?
Exactly. And I think the government is trying...
I'm just not sure whether that's binding, that's saying that we should read that to say, unless it's explicit, it's not sufficiently specific.
I think I would rely on the guideline and the commentary using the language of contempt, and that in contempt cases it has to be explicit. I would say that... the government's position here is that there doesn't either have to be an explicit order or a prior fraud. And those two things in combination strain the language of the guidelines past the breaking point. There's no case that the government has cited and no case I'm aware of that says you can apply this guideline where you don't have any explicit order or a prior finding of fraud. And for that reason, the court should vacate and remand for resentencing without the application of this guideline.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel are excused.